ugliness, an ugly, ugly underside, which start to come out in Israel's last assault on Gaza, when they start to post on the web the videos of their enthusiasm as they destroy Palestinian homes, as they humiliated and degraded Palestinian women and Palestinian men.
Thank you once again, Norman, for sitting here with me today to talk about Palestine, and of course for inviting us to your lovely home. I'm hoping that as we're approaching October 7th, the anniversary of it, that we could look at some of the events that you feel are most defining in terms of what they can tell us about the world, about Palestine, and also your approach that you take in your own work. But before that, I'm wondering if you might be able to speak to when you first began to take the suffering of others seriously.
I grew up in a very political home. First of all, it was the 1960s where politics was permeating the atmosphere, the environment. But even were it not the 1960s, still my parents were very cognizant and impassioned by what was going on in the world. Our conversations at the dinner table, the programs they selected to watch, it was a very political home. And I remember just in that point, I had a brilliant friend. His name was Mark Cohn. And his parents were very distinguished in intellectual life. One was a very prominent physician, the father, and the mother was a university professor. Mm-hmm. And everybody was in awe of this family. They were the Cohns, C-O-H-N-S. And the son, who was my best friend, he passed earlier than should have been the case, mm-hmm. in cancer. Really brilliant person. And shortly before passing, we had an extensive email correspondence. And one of the things was kind of surprising. My parents were formally in their appearance, they were not impressive. My father was a factory worker, and my mother basically, she was a stay-at-home mom to raise the three children, because we didn't have any living relatives, so you didn't have somebody to do the babysitting. Mm-hmm. You know, there were no aunts, there were no uncles, there were no cousins, there were no grandparents, mm-hmm. so she had to stay home. And they dressed very drab, very drab. And then there were the Cohns. They were doctors. And he commented to me shortly before he died. He said, I always wanted to go to your house because I felt like your family was talking about significant things. Okay. And my family, all they were interested in is with their careers and personal advancement,
right.
Personal aggrandizement. And I was kind of shocked, I have to say, because they were the Cohns. And we were the very humble Finkelstein family, very humble Finkelstein family. But there was, it never really occurred to me because it was so natural. But all we talked about was world affairs, nonstop. So it's not as if there were a point at which I suddenly became sensitive to the world's sufferings. My parents were impassioned and indignant at injustice. They were also impassioned and indignant, impassioned in support of the Soviet Union, indignant at any criticism of it. Now, you might say that was wrongheaded, but it doesn't change the fact that they cared about politics. Even I was thinking, a week before my mother died, she died of a terrible cancer. It ate up her whole face. Mm. Her face was all blood and boils. It was like out of a science fiction movie. And I remember a week before she died, she said to me, "Norman, tell me what's going on in the world. What's going on in the world?" Mm-hmm. It was so deep in her bones that it was a point where obviously it made no difference what was going on in the world, because she was quite soon thereafter not going to be part of the world. Mm. But it didn't alter her an iota. It's like, you know, Professor Chomsky, 95, 96, he's still arguing about the Ukraine as if he were 20. Mm. As if he were 20. Sometimes in the back of your head, you're thinking, Professor Chomsky, why do you care? You may not wake up tomorrow morning. Didn't make a difference. It didn't make a whit of difference to him, and it didn't make a whit of difference to my parents. It was in the marrow of their bones. Mm. And it became the same thing with me.
Would you describe that as coming sort of from a moral impulse?
Yeah, fundamentally, yes. It was about injustice.
Yes.
It's always about injustice. For me, and I think I got this from Professor Chomsky, for me, it's the indignation at the lies. Mm-hmm. My parents never cared too much about the lies. They were very confident. They were very confident in their point of view, and everybody else was an idiot. Mm-hmm. They're all just stupid, mm-hmm. You know. But for me, writing is cathartic. It's therapeutic, because it enables me to expose to the world, which frankly consists only of me, because nobody reads what I write, is so dense. But I get this kind of vindication and revenge when on the computer screen I can expose the lies. So it's not just, you know, the twin values throughout moral history have been truth and justice. Mm. My parents were concerned about the justice. They weren't too concerned about the truth, because they were confident that they knew the truth and that everybody else was an idiot. Mm. I can't say I'm nearly as confident of the truth. I think truth is a process that you have to struggle with, and you have to work out not only the veracity, the truthfulness of your argument, you have to expose the falsity of the argument against yours. My parents never cared about exposing the falsity. What do they know? If I ever dare talk about war, let's say I would talk about war, she'd look at me. What do you know about war? It's like, Professor Chomsky, obviously, he has two departments of his mind. There's the scientific side, and then there's the social justice side. I learned very early on, never say anything about science. Don't dare utter a word. because he's going to give that look in his face like, Norman, can you tell me what you know about So I was very, very careful. I would ask him questions, you know, like, where do you stand in the, does IQ measure intelligence? You know, I would ask him, in your opinion, does IQ measure intelligence? I was entitled, there was a TV show when I was growing up. It was called Ask Mr. Wizard. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Wizard was a scientist, and little children would ask him questions about science. Ask Mr. Wizard. And Chomsky was like, Mr. Wizard, you're allowed to ask him questions about science, but don't dare venture an opinion. Mm-hmm. So, what do you know? And that was my parents. It was, mm-hmm. What do you know? So, but for me, I'm interested, of course, I'm committed to it. I'm not just interested in. I have deep convictions about justice, but I'm also concerned about truth and how you arrive at it, how you can feel confident about your truth, and how you can demonstrate that everybody who disagrees with you, how you can demonstrate that they're wrong, which is a very different thing than dismissing them as wrong. Yes. I don't dismiss. Either I have to demonstrate, either I demonstrate, or I have to plead agnosticism. Mm-hmm. I don't have title to dismiss.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the truth of the world, mm-hmm. What do you feel that events that have transpired since October 7th might reveal about that? And if it goes beyond just the cruelty and the injustice that we're seeing play out in Gaza, maybe you can speak to that.
I think it brought into relief a deeply pathological and ugly aspect of Israeli society, which people wanted to marginalize, as in, yes, Israel did this wrong, Israel did that wrong, you know, all states do terrible things. But I think it goes beyond that. I think about it a lot. There's a real, it's not even a sickness, it's an ugliness, an ugly, ugly underside, which start to come out in Israel's last assault on Gaza, when they start to post on the web the videos of their enthusiasm as they destroy Palestinian homes, as they humiliated and degraded Palestinian women and Palestinian men. If you look at the last report from the UN Human Rights Council, the commission that wrote the report was chaired by Navi Pillay, who was the former High Commissioner for Human Rights. And in her legal conclusions, she accused Israel of two crimes against humanity. One was the crime of extermination. Mm-hmm. But there was a second one which was quite interesting. It was the crime of persecution. And the persecution was not of women. It was the crime against humanity of persecution to Muslim men and boys. Mm. This systematic targeting of the men, the males in Gaza, for moral and physical degradation. And I came, this is a side note, I came as a result of watching what was unfolding in Gaza. If you remember, and this is not the past tense, it's the present tense too, they always said number of women and children killed, yes, as if women and children was a proxy for civilians. Mm-hmm. So in normal human rights reports, they have two categories, combatants and civilians. But in the unfolding horror in Gaza, the two categories became women and children on one side, men on the other. Not civilians versus combatants, but women and children versus men, as if every male in Gaza was a legitimate target. Every male in Gaza was a legitimate target. And when you read the Israeli distinctions, when they talk about the number of Hamas militants they killed, do you know what that number is? It's the number of men they killed. Hamas doesn't wear uniforms. They don't carry around IDs that say Hamas terrorist. How would Israel know how many of those it killed were Hamas militants and how many were just civilians? They don't even make the distinction. So to return to your question, I know that was a long diversion, but it's still relevant. To return to your question, I think a real ugly underside to Israel, not just, well, we know, in war, there are always some rotten apples in the barrel, and there are always excesses. No, these weren't excesses. These weren't rotten apples. This was the rot at the core of Israeli society, the rot at the core of this obnoxious, narcissistic Jewish supremacist society had come to the surface. And it was, has been, it's been quite shocking. Mm-hmm. It's quite shocking to observe. And it causes one to wonder at the capacity of this society for self-reform, the capacity. And I am dubious at this point with each passing day, with the reading of each new human rights report, with each new massacre and murder that occurs, now at a point where it doesn't even raise eyebrows anymore. Each day, another school, another refugee center. they just killed 22 here, 60 here, 100 there. Nobody even thinks twice anymore. It's a sight to behold. It's as if, in Freudian language or in Freud's speculations, we have a thing called the ego, which is our self-focused concerns. And then there's what Freud calls a superego. And the superego is when you internalize some external authority which keeps your ego in check. I know that sounds a little bit sophisticated, so just simply, whenever you're thinking about doing something wrong, right? You think about doing something wrong, immediately an image of your mother comes into your mind, or an image of your father comes into mind, telling you, you shouldn't do that. I have, depending on the circumstance, I have many super egos. If I let the water running, I think about a famous environmentalist who I deeply respected, Pete Seeger. And I would say, what would Pete Seeger think? And then I would shut the water, mm-hmm. you know? In other circumstances, I would think of my mother. I would think of my father. And in quite a few circumstances, it's Chomsky, mm-hmm. you know? The superego, Freud says, watches garrison-like over your ego. And Israel has no superego. It doesn't. It does whatever it wants. Mm. Nothing, no authority figure constrains it or reins it in. It's Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, going to the UN and saying, you're all anti-Semitic bile, which is what he said in his last speech. It can't be that we might be doing something wrong, because Jews can do no wrong. It has to be anti-Semitism, because mm-hmm. Jews can do no wrong. And that's an ego, the stupefying narcissism, uncontrolled, out of control. And that's Israel. Mm-hmm. It's a stupefying narcissism, completely out of control. Mm. And anchored in the deep-seated belief that Jews can do no wrong, and if we're criticized, it's because they're envious of us, because we're better. They're envious of us. And why are they envious of us? Because we're better.
Mm. Do you feel, because this fear of being labeled an anti-Semite, according to this sort of logic, if you will, that exists in the culture, has in some way, directly or indirectly, pigeonholed you to be the quote-unquote Jewish academic or writer or thinker, so forth, who is like the exception to the rule, who's called on to?
I would find it regrettable if that were the case. Now, it's true, and I want to be fair to the record. When I started out 40-some years ago, 42 years ago, with the war in Lebanon, I was the exceptional Jew, and I took advantage of it because I thought it would be useful to the cause. I mean, we're talking about 42 years ago, when to be Jewish and critical of Israel, there were only a very small handful of people. And it served a political purpose to identifying yourself as Jewish. I do not believe, but I could be wrong, I do not believe nowadays people pay special attention to the fact that I'm Jewish. They pay attention to the fact that I know a lot, that I can reason through an argument, that I can answer the rapid-fire lies that come my way or come the way of those who are trying to oppose what's going on. So I do not believe, but I could be mistaken. I could be in denial to some extent, but I think when people hear me now, they're not saying, oh, so good to hear a Jew saying that. No, so good to hear Norman Finkelstein saying that, because he knows how to answer the arguments. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to be remembered for. I don't want to be remembered because I was Jewish. Mm-hmm. I want to be remembered because I spent about 42 years plunged in all of these books and documents, trying to make sense of it and trying to be able to be intellectually effective. As I said, it wasn't just me, quote unquote, supporting the Palestinians as a principle of justice. No, it was me defending the Palestinians as a principle of justice based on truth, based on having spent, devoted, invested the whole of my adult life to trying to make sense of what's happening.
Over the summer, you remarked to me, interestingly, over the phone when we were preparing for this interview, something very interesting about how engaging in something that takes a lot of work or trying to produce something that takes a lot of work is only worth it if it has originality and value. And I'm wondering if you can, I find it very interesting. I'm wondering if you can expound on that and maybe speak to like when you yourself know you're on that track.
Well, Professor Chomsky, there's a very good Israeli, he used to say of historians, he would say of historians, they're basically good clerks because they go in an archive, they find information, and then they try to organize the information in a coherent narrative. Mm-hmm. And for Professor Chomsky, that's basically what a clerk does. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you use the expression clerk nowadays, but when we thought of a clerk, we thought of somebody who did just that. And I wanted to be a little more than a clerk. I wanted what everybody strives to do. You know, there's everybody wants in life a little bit of fame and a little bit of fortune. Mm-hmm. A little bit of fame and a little bit of fortune. And the way you not so much get fame, but self-gratification, is the knowledge that you're doing something that most other people can't do. Mm-hmm. Because if you're only doing what other people do, you're easily duplicated, which makes you kind of redundant. Mm-hmm. Now, when I first met Professor Chomsky, you don't feel redundant. You know, you feel like anything you do, he already did. Right. And you can only be derivative. Mm. And being derivative is not a terrific feeling. It makes you kind of redundant, replaceable. And I wanted to be able to do something not on the order of Einstein's relativity or Chomskyan linguistics, but I wanted to be able to do something that others couldn't do, or most others couldn't do, or most others, because it's so tedious and boring, they wouldn't want to do. And so I feel that over time, I mastered a called a craft or a skill or an ability, which I believe is not easily duplicable. So to give you an example of something that made me feel good, resonated with my inner being, I recently wrote a long examination of the dissents by dissenting opinions by the Vice President of the International Court of Justice, Julia Sebutindi. And it's a very tedious examination to try to demonstrate that what she's saying is completely incoherent. And given that she has the competence to be on the highest judicial body in the world, I have to assume that she is conscious of what she's doing. She's not incompetent, which means there are only two possibilities. She's either being bribed or blackmailed by Israel. And so I produced this document or chapter in the forthcoming book, and I sent it to several people to go over. And one of them wrote back to me, I'll give you his name, Talal Hungari, a recent graduate of I think either Oxford or Cambridge, I can't remember now which. And he wrote back to me and he said, I have to say, Norman, that I don't think there is any living being in the world who could have done what you did in this chapter. And that's kind of what I was striving for. I wanted, it's the sense that if you don't do it, it won't get done. And that's been a driving force for me, for my adult life. I always have this fear that I'll die before it's done. And it's valuable. Yes. So I've got to get it done. I sometimes think the Israelis might decide it's my time to pull the plug on me. So every night when I finish working, I send copies to three people. So they enter my email or whatever, enter my computer, and they erase everything, that there'll be three copies out there. It's a feeling of, it's not on the order of Newtonian physics, Einsteinian relativity, or Chomsky linguistics, but there's a certain amount of feeling of personal value to what I'm doing. That's what I was referring to when I said, I don't want to just be a clerk.
Right.
It has to have value and it has to have originality. Mm-hmm. And when I feel, let's say if I'm starting to write something and it's coming very easily, it's just mellifluous, you know what happens? I stop and I say, Norm, it's coming too easily. You should be struggling more. My mother used to say about my prose, she said, reading you is like reading, it's like molasses dripping out of a bottle. There was the very first book I was contributor to was a book called Blaming the Victims. Mm-hmm. It came out during the first intifada in the first Palestinian civil uprising about 1989. And it was edited by Edward Said. Mm-hmm. And there were like 10 essays in the book, maybe more, I can get off my shelf, 10 or 12 essays in the book. And my mother, who I mentioned to you before the interview began, she was a voracious reader. She used to say, I read every chapter in the book twice, except yours, I skipped. And I thought to myself, that was a wise move. Mm-hmm. That was a wise move. Mm-hmm. I struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes I have written, I didn't write, the last book I wrote was the book on cancel culture and identity politics. There was a lot in it which was genuinely, I think people tell me and I agree, it was genuinely funny. When I was writing the book, I would send chapters to Professor Chomsky. And Professor Chomsky, whenever he would always write back as if he's, for 40 years, he's my mentor, and this is very serious. And so he would give me very dense, exacting criticism. When I sent him the chapters to this book, he kept writing back, hilarious. I thought to myself, good, I made austere Professor Chomsky laugh.
Absolutely. It's got a different tone.
Yeah, it's a totally different tone. Yeah. It's my ego without the superego. No holds barred, no constraints.
You know, actually, I feel this might link to the question that I was hoping to ask, and it comes back to your mother and something you did once make a remark about. At one point, you thought you were going, if I'm correct, too far, to use that word, too far. And I'm wondering if you could maybe speak to that. Does that, you feel, still apply to you today? Is it?
there are several things to say about that. Number one, I think it's fair to say, and I'm not going to shy away from the truth. Mm-hmm. My parents were very critical of Jews mm-hmm. because they had seen the ugly side. They were in the ghetto. They were in the concentration camps. Mm-hmm. They saw the Jewish collaborators. Mm-hmm. They saw all kinds of betrayal that shocked them in real time. When the Jews in the ghetto, the Warsaw ghetto, they dug what were called bunkers, basically catacombs underneath the ghetto, okay? They built them with their bare hands. They dug them with their bare hands. And then other Jews went with the Gestapo to show where the bunkers were. There were the collaborators called the Judenrat, the Jewish councils, who in exchange for saving their own lives pointed to the other Jews to go to the gas chambers. They knew they were going to gas chambers and lied to them and said what the Nazis were saying, you're being resettled in the East. That's the expression they use. Pack up your bags, we're resettling you in the East. The Judenrats knew, they were the Jewish councils. It was Jews. Mm-hmm. So they saw a very ugly side. And they were very critical of Jews. But sometimes, when I adopted that outrage and indignation, they felt I had to be careful about not going too far in condemning what Jews were doing. Now, I am cognizant, aware of that now. But there's another consideration, and it's there all the time with me now. I get very warm, decent emails from many Jews who thank me for what I'm doing. And I have to ask myself, with each of my public utterances, will I go too far? Am I going too far and will alienate them? Mm-hmm. I don't want to lose them. They are kind. They are generous. They are soul searching. They are outraged at what's happening, but I can go, they're not ready to go where I've gone. Mm-hmm. Even my dearest protege, but now he's also my comrade, equal, Jamie Stern Weiner, who I'm closest to of all my young little army of people who I work with. And in the last interview I did, I used an expression which I've used several times. I said that satanic state. And he wrote to me, I said to him, "Now, Jamie, tell me what you think I did right and tell me what I did wrong. I need to know. I need, you know, the reality checks." And he said, "Well, you know, I always disagreed with the satanic state." No, he's Jewish, Jamie Stern Weiner. His father is Israeli. And I might be going too far for him. And I tried to explain to him, I said, "Jamie," who I think the world of, if you did what I did for 40 years, just keep reading those human rights reports, keep seeing what's happening. I said, you know, when you read about Israeli snipers targeting double amputees on the nonviolent civil disobedience in Gaza, when you read about doctors in Gaza hospital saying there are all these children coming in with no shrapnel, which means there was no bombing or anything, just bullet wounds to the skull. They were targeting the skull of children. It's kind of hard to resist going to the place of satanic state. But of course, if I'm losing Jamie, I have to ask myself, how far should I go? Because there are a large number of Jews, not the majority, but certainly a large number, who now look to me because I was, so to speak, ahead of the curve. And it was sort of like with Bernie Sanders. Why did the young people respect Bernie Sanders? Because he had been saying it for 40 years. He was the real McCoy. It wasn't somebody who was just climbing on the bandwagon. And people recognize, well, you know, he seems like he was right about a lot in the past, you know. And so I have to be careful in the second sense. For my parents, the going too far meant, remember, you're a Jew. And there's a certain, there should be a certain self, I don't want to call pride, a self-respect that comes with being who you are, the self-respect. So you have to be careful. And I think they felt, I'll give you another example, but this was another kind of going too far. Mm-hmm. So far I gave you the too far in terms of losing your self-respect. Mm-hmm. There was a second too far of losing people who mean a lot to me and who have come, and I have come to mean a lot too. And then there was the third kind, which was, I remember I was in sixth grade. I even have the picture sitting on my piano of my sixth grade class. Okay. I was in sixth grade. It was 1964, and it was the war in Vietnam. But it was already, it was the beginning where very few people were against the war. Very few people were against the war. In my home, totally against what the US was doing in Vietnam, outrage, indignation at the killing, the horrors that were being inflicted on the people of Vietnam. And there was going to be a debate in class on Vietnam. And I remember my parents saying, and I was going to repeat what my parents said at home. I didn't know anything. You know, I'm sixth grade, what do I know? I was going to repeat, and I said, Norman, make arguments on the other side also. I was shocked. Other side? I've never heard other side in this house. But that was another going too far, that I was going to get myself in a lot of trouble. Mm. So, don't go too far, because I'll tell you a funny story. I'm in sixth grade. That's saying, can you bring the picture? It's sitting on the piano.
Yes. That's the one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. So this is sixth grade. This was me, and that was my best friend, Mark Cohn, the one I mentioned earlier, the comics. And so I get up in class and I say, I think Lyndon Johnson, who was the president of the United States then, I said, I believe he is being belligerent. Now, for sixth grade, belligerent was a very impressive word. Mm-hmm. It means warlike, belligerent. And I remember my teacher, who's here, Mrs. Miesenberg, she said, "Sit down, Norman, you don't even know what that word means." She was half right. I only learned the word the day before, and I was very excited about using it. So that was another too far, which actually the too far they were most worried about. And they were worried that I would end up in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And they also expected I would end up dead.
Okay.
And that was, I think it troubled my mother's conscience. I was a kind of Frankenstein's monster that I had taken too literally. Mm-hmm. I had taken too literally what she was saying. And basically what she was saying was that, you know, what's happening is horrible. What happened to us, meaning she and her family, and that if you're silent, then you are in complicity with the horror. Mm-hmm. And I took that to heart, so I wouldn't be silent. As a matter of fact, in that photo, it says, when I'm demonstrating right in front of the Israeli consulate, it says, "This son of survivors of Auschwitz, of the Warsaw Ghetto, Auschwitz and Majdanek concentration camp, will not be silent. Israeli Nazis stopped the Holocaust in Lebanon." And so they were, I think it was a guilty conscience that my mother would be held responsible if I got killed. I mean, obviously she didn't want me to get killed because she liked the fact that I was alive, but it was also the guilt that I would. There was a real fear back then.
Yes.
There was a real fear. So,
Do you feel that universities make it easier or difficult to go too far, these universities as we see them today?
Well, this is something completely unprecedented. Yes. What's happening now on the college campuses, the level of repression has no precedent since the early 1960s. Now, there was a lot of repression, and that triggered what was called, referring to the University of California at Berkeley, it triggered what was called the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. Mm-hmm. And the free speech movement was all about ridding the college campus of all the political taboos and limits on free speech. Now, by the 1960s and early 70s, there were no taboos. Mm-hmm. No, there were no taboos. And you had your tables, you can organize for socialist revolution, communist revolution, smashing the bourgeois state, anything and everything. Everything went. And now, we're seeing a very dramatic and serious regression, basically because of the billionaire Jewish supremacist supporters of Israel. Because Jews are rich. They're the wealthiest, what's called religious ethnic group in the United States. They are the richest. And they tend to support liberal causes. And so they give lots of money to universities, lots of money to the arts world. If you go into Lincoln Center, you go into a library. There was always a plaque nowadays of the donors who gave. And the plaques are always 75% Jewish. And that's a good thing. Jews take it as a source of pride to give to institutions which advance culture and the elevation of the mind. That's a good thing. unfortunately, it has an underside or a downside. It means incredible cultural power. And now they are, or the Jewish supremacist billionaire class, they're exerting that power. It's not just at the Ivy Leagues. Mm-hmm. Not just at the mm-hmm. Ivy Leagues. You take City University of New York. Mm-hmm. They're terrified. Because a lot of the graduates of even the City University of New York, they who are Jewish, they made it. They became very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And now the screws are being turned. The screws are being turned. Either clamp down on these anti-Israel, anti-Semitic demonstrations, or you're not getting our money. And so the repression has been actually, it's been beyond belief. You can't say anything now critical of Israel. So far, we're now, as you're interviewing me, we're beginning October, so there's been roughly about a month of classes. So far, the schools have been very quiescent. They've been very quiet. I suspect because the students are trying to figure out how do we move forward? What do we do? I would guess that after last spring, remember, a place like Columbia, it costs $90,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That's not small change. And a lot of the students, they were threatened with suspension, expulsion, non-attendance at graduation, but then something 1,000 times worse. They were told that if you participated, you're not getting a job here. You're not getting a job there. You're not coming to this law firm. So it was going to follow them. Mm-hmm. Follow them through the whole of their life's journey. And so my guess is there were a lot of very anguished conversations between the students and their parents this mm-hmm. past summer. And a lot of ultimatums that if you don't stop, we're not paying your tuition. So right now, the schools have been quiescent. But also, I think they're trying to figure out mm-hmm. how to proceed. Mm-hmm. And we'll wait to see how effective those draconian repressive measures have been.
Without presuming anything, I just want to ask you, like, what do you think is at the fore of the minds of these donors who are telling the universities?
Oh, I have no doubt what's at the fore.
Is it like you're embarrassing Israel, or is it
Jews can do no wrong? Okay, that's why I say they're Jewish supremacists. They don't really care about Israel. They don't really care about Israel. They care about Jews. There was a famous social critic, his name was Irving Howe. And Irving Howe once said, if you have $100 in your pocket and you don't buy a one-way ticket to Israel, that's how much it cost back then you're not a Zionist. Mm-hmm. If you're a Zionist and you want to go build a Jewish state, blah, 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 blah. But if you stay here, you don't really care about the Jewish state. They don't care about the Jewish state. They care about Jews. And Jews can do no wrong. And if anyone criticizes them, it must be because they're jealous, because they're envious. So I think they're Jewish supremacists.
It sounds almost like a fear of somebody's reputation being sullied.
Excuse me?
It sounds almost like a fear of someone's reputation.
No, it's an indignation. How dare you criticize us?
Yes, yes.
How dare you criticize the Ubermensch, the Superman? Part of it I get. You know, there's two aspects to it. There's what you can call the otherworldly and the worldly aspect. The otherworldly aspect is the whole notion of the Jewish people as the chosen people and how that can easily be perverted into being chosen in the sense of being superior, even though that wasn't originally what the idea of chosen people were. But it can easily be perverted into the idea of chosen in the sense of being Ubermensch, Superman. Mm-hmm. But then there's the worldly side, which I frankly have to admit, there's a lot of truth to it. I'll give you an example. So this is my sixth grade class, which we've already referred to. You take Mark Cohn, brilliant guy, I've already said it. He eventually became the chief technology officer, the CTO of Unisys, which is one of the biggest computer companies in the world. It's based in Washington, okay? So then we have here, we have Virginia DiMario. She became a doctor. Zori Cohn, she became a doctor. Michelle Alata, she became a doctor. And there are many who became doctors I don't even know. Now remember, I'm talking about girls here. At that time, a girl doctor? Very, very unusual. It was just at the beginning of what came to be called the Women's Liberation Movement. Mm-hmm. There were no, or just a handful of female doctors. But they all made it. So when Jews experience this utterly spectacular earthly success, they are 20 or 25% of Nobel laureates. I went to visit my high school a few months ago. And at the entrance to the high school, James Madison High School, they have all the famous graduates. A big board. Not one, not two, not three, not four, not five. From my public high school, not a private high school, six Nobel laureates. Six Nobel laureates in physics, chemistry, biology, economics. The Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, my high school. Bernie Sanders, my high school. I could go on and on. Even I am astonished. Even I am astonished. When I looked at that, I said, holy Toledo. It can't but go to your head that there must be something special about Jews. It's intoxicating, not just because of the religious notion of the chosen people, but it seems to have been validated in worldly success. So people get carried away with that. And then they figure everybody must be jealous of us. Everybody must be envious. And if you hurl a criticism, or even utter a criticism, it can only be motivated by anti-Semitism. That's what they believe.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's been such an illuminating discussion. You've been so generous with your time.